Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Hallbrooks, Judge Slater, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning. Our first case this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Curtis Anderson. Whenever appellant's counsel is ready, you can approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. The appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent 15 minutes, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I'm here this morning representing the appellant, Mr. Curtis Anderson. Mr. Anderson has raised 5 issues for this court's consideration, and this morning I would like to begin by focusing on issue 2 related to the jury instructions, and in particular, the permissive inference instruction. I have 1 point of housekeeping as we begin. Respondent argues in its brief that I failed to cite to the record for the proposition that Mr. Anderson objected to this instruction. So I am now reading to the court from pages 536 to 537 of the trial transcript. This is the second instance where the parties and judge discuss the 152.028 instruction, and the public defender says, quote, "I don't remember if I actually noted my objection to section 152.028 coming in as part of the instruction. I do object to that as a whole coming in." She then explains her reasons. It was that page that was cited at page 21 of my brief. I'm not sure exactly what the quibble is, but if it was unclear, I apologize to this court. As to the substance of the issue, we have an objection, and we have a clearly erroneous instruction. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said 4 times, you cannot give this instruction. The reason is because it isolates one factual inference for the jury and tells them it is permissible. As the court noted in Olson, it was not a balanced instruction on the various relevant factors bearing on the jury's determination of the disputed possession issue, but rather was one which singled out and unfairly emphasized one factor, one piece of the circumstantial evidence bearing on that determination, thereby suggesting to the jury that in the court's opinion, that factor was of greater importance than other relevant factors. That's exactly what this instruction did, and it was erroneous. It was also prejudicial. This was the sole disputed factual issue in this case. The rest of the elements are really undisputed. These are controlled substances. No one had any lawful reason to possess them, and they're found in this vehicle. The question was, whose are they? Were they Mr. Anderson's, were they Ms. Smith's, or were they both? That was what the jury really had to decide. And this inference isolated that one fact for them and said, you can find him guilty because he's the driver, period. The jury, we presume juries follow instructions. Lay jurors would no doubt pay attention to that instruction. And it came from the court. It came from the lips of the district court judge telling them, this is one permissible inference you can make. That certainly affected the jury's consideration. And to affirm here, this court would have to say, beyond a reasonable doubt, there was no significant impact on the verdict. Remember that this instruction was given 4 times, not once, 4 times, one for each count. And additionally, it was sort of interwoven into the elements of the offenses. It wasn't a separate and distinct instruction. It was part of the definition of possession. So as the jury's told what possession means, you need to find possession, you need to find constructive possession. That's pretty clear here. This was defined for them as you can find him guilty because he was the driver. This issue alone, I believe, merits a remand for a new trial for Mr. Anderson, but it's not the only error.
Ms. Yoke-Erickson, on that issue as to whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, you certainly have the lottery ticket, which is problematic, but what are we to do with the phone call? I mean, that's, I would imagine the jury might have focused a lot on that. And, well, I'll just end there.
Perhaps, Your Honor. So it is important that we look at the words that were used during this phone call. And certainly, If you look at the phone call from the perspective of these are his drugs, it looks pretty incriminating. But if we look at it neutrally, we don't make any assumptions about what's going on, who's the drugs are, what does he say? He says, I got into some shit, excuse my language. That's true. He's been arrested. He admitted there's a marijuana pipe in the car. He admitted he possessed some of the marijuana. He's got drug priors. He knows he's in trouble. What else does he say? It was both of us. There's multiple ways to interpret that statement as well. It is both of them in the car. They've both been arrested. They've both been interviewed. It's important to note what he never says. He never says, well, yeah, they were my drugs, but she's holding them for me, or they were my drugs, but she's going to take the fall. When he says she will take the charge, he doesn't say for me. He doesn't say she agreed to take the charge, that there's any sort of conversation between them, that she's taking the fall for him, so to speak. So if you read that neutrally, he's saying she's taking responsibility. She's owning up to this.
But because she has a lower criminal history score or, you know, lack of a past, I don't remember the specific language.
But he says that as well, mm-hmm. to be sure. But as to the jury instruction issue, this court is not asking whether there's sufficient evidence to convict. Again, Olson is a really helpful case on this point. So Olson is one of the four Minnesota Supreme Court cases with this kind of instruction. And in Olson, the evidence was also pretty damning against Mr. Olson. It was a house case. Drugs are found in his house. He's there. They're kind of out in the open. He says he saw them. And the court notes, while there was undoubtedly more than enough circumstantial evidence here to support the guilty verdict, we are concerned about the possible impact of the instruction in this case. They go on to say, shortly thereafter, although defendant probably, they emphasize that word, would have been convicted in any event, we cannot conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he would have been convicted in any event.
In Olson, was there a similar sort of, I don't know, I guess I'll use the word admission, as there is in this case? Well, that's my word, not yours.
Sure, yes. So Mr. Olson tells law enforcement at some point that he saw the drugs. We don't even have that here, right? Mr. Anderson denies that he knew what was in that cooler or was aware of it. So it's not exactly the same, but certainly you have some level of acknowledgement of an element of the offense that is knowledge. You know, just to touch on the sufficiency as a standalone issue briefly, Your Honor, there are many facts, many circumstances proved that support the inference that these are Smith's drugs and hers alone. She's got three different baggies of methamphetamine on her person, one in her purse, one in her pocket, one in her coffee mug. She's also got lots of implements of use and sale in her purse, which we officer says is her purse, right? She's got needles. She's got a tourniquet. She's got a section of mirror. She's got empty baggies. She's got a scale. Those are things that a drug dealer possesses. The scale exactly matches another scale found in the cooler. All of that suggests that those are her drugs. She's the drug dealer. Mr. Anderson knew nothing about these drugs. He's quite candid with the officers about his use, his possession of a marijuana pipe. He even claims some of the marijuana, right? But he denies that he had any knowledge of what was in that cooler found at her feet. There are many...
It would be fair to say, Ms. Yelker-Aronson, that they could both possess the meth in the cooler.
They can, as a matter of law. And I believe I was, which I agree, I stated in my brief, that's one inference, right? Absolutely. There's no question. That's a reasonable inference on this record. The question is there another one? And is there another reasonable inference consistent with innocence, which is those are only hers. The drugs are only hers. And remember, even though the state's theory is joint constructive possession, the prosecutor said that explicitly in closing argument, she's not charged. She's not a co-defendant here. She doesn't get charged with any of this stuff. She's charged with the gross misdemeanor for the trace on her person. So even though that's the state's theory, that they jointly constructively possess the stuff, whether they believe it or not, they didn't charge Ms. Smith. So there are plenty of inferences from this record that those were only her drugs. The call can be explained. I imagine it sort of say we're doing a plain language analysis of that call. There's multiple inferences from it. One is that he's saying it was my stuff and she's taken the fall. Another is that he's saying she's just owning up to it. She's taking responsibility because they were her drugs. And the ticket, I think the clearest explanation of it is to look at the handwriting on the ticket and the handwriting in the planner, which is evidence in the record, exhibits 34 through 36. Whoever these people are that are doing this writing, they're two different people. So one person has the planner and one person has the ticket. Several different inferences you can conclude from that is that the person whose planner it is, the planner's in the cooler, is Ms. Smith, and she found the ticket, and she grabbed it. We don't know how much money it's worth. It could be $2, it could be $100,000. Or that it's payment. and that Mr. Anderson, a drug user, was going to buy drugs from her, and that was part of his payment. There's lots of reasons she may have this ticket that he's filled out.
But there's no question it was his signature on the back. I mean, that was not an issue at trial.
Well, it's his name. I'll put it that way, certainly. And I think the most reasonable inference is that he's the one that filled it out.
Uh-huh.
Nonetheless, it's found in this planner that's someone else's handwriting. So for those reasons, we would ask you to conclude that the evidence was insufficient to find that Mr. Anderson jointly constructively possessed the cooler, which is where all the drugs are found. I noted earlier that there are multiple errors here, and that is true. We have several evidentiary errors in this trial as well, and they compound on each other. They end up with this cumulative impact where it wasn't a fair trial. So one of these errors is the district court prohibited any impeachment of Officer Vosacek. He lied in a trial about a Rasmussen hearing about 2 months earlier. Judge Redding in Hennepin County District Court so found in a court order suppressing evidence. When defense counsel tried to impeach him by asking questions about it, the court first allowed it. She allowed it during the Rasmussen hearing. He was asked several relatively direct impeachment questions, and he answered them. The parties then litigated whether he could be impeached at trial in a similar fashion. The judge first concluded that it was a specific instance of untruthfulness under 608B. That was correct. But she then disallowed the defense from asking impeachment questions at trial, and that was error.
Go ahead, Judge.
Well, in this case, I know in the case before Judge Redding, it seemed there were 8, I believe, instances where, you know, there was actual demonstrated indication of his lying.
Yes.
I think it was the video versus his testimony.
Yes.
We didn't have something like that in this case, correct?
Well, we don't have to. He can be impinged with...
Well, I know, but I'm just saying.
Not that we know of.
It may be, I presume, as a result of the Rasmussen hearing that the judge concluded that the same sort of circumstances didn't exist here, and therefore this evidence from an unrelated case really was prejudicial and not, you know, helpful to come in.
Well, that's not exactly what the judge concluded. So she allowed it in. She said the next day she didn't consider it. So she didn't say... I didn't think it was admissible, so she just says I didn't consider it.
At Rasmussen?
Yes, as to the issue of the Rasmussen, right, which she denies the defense challenge and then we move on.
Hmm.
Her reasons for excluding the impeachment questions at trial have nothing to do with prejudice. She says it's opinion evidence. She says we might have to call Judge Redding, which is none of which was suggested by defense counsel. She was very clear about what she wanted to do. She wanted to ask impeachment questions. She specifically disclaimed any intention, any... even belief that she would be allowed to introduce the order itself. She says, I can't. I have to ask him questions. If he says no or whatever he says, I'm stuck with that answer. That's how we do impeachment. She should have been permitted to do that.
Difficult to say it's an abuse of discretion, given the, you know, serious consideration the court gave it.
Yeah. Well, I think two things, Your Honor. One is that I would ask this court to consider the seriousness of Officer Vosacek's conduct and the rarity of it.
Even in this other case?
Even in this other case, this is an officer of the law who goes into court, is sworn as a witness, and testifies in many different ways that are just objectively inconsistent with his squad video, right? He doesn't say, I don't remember, which would have been totally fine.
Yeah.
He doesn't try to soften that at all. In fact, Judge Redding went out of her way to note he testified confidently. If that's any other witness, they're allowed to be impeached, right? And this is rare. It is rare that a district court judge writes an order saying, I am granting the defense suppression motion because I don't believe this officer. There's no reason, no legal reason that they can't do that impeachment. So it's abuse of discretion because when the judge gives her reasons, they're not correct. They're not correct on the law. This is not opinion testimony. It's not hearsay. We're not trying to introduce the order. That's very clear. And there's no reason it wasn't permissible. So issues 3 and 4 in appellant's brief, they work together. Because really, the state's allowed to have it both ways, and the defense is hamstrung throughout. So they're not allowed to impeach this witness, who is crucial. He's the only person that even saw this vehicle, right? Because Anderson doesn't testify and Ms. Smith doesn't testify. The other officers are always sort of, they come in later, right? So he's the only one that's there. He's the only one that can tell the jury where this stuff was found.
So what, presumably then, how would it have worked? So you would have wanted defense counsel to ask the officer, so is it true that in another case, the district court judge found your testimony to be not credible? I mean, or you tell me, what question did you want answered?
Certainly, Your Honor. And one thing that, remember, she's already done this in the Rasmussen hearing.
Right.
So there's sort of a model for what she could have done. But I think one thing defense counsel could have done is start by saying, did you testify on X date and X case? Yes or no? Right? He can say no. And he can also impeach. Witnesses who are being impeached can always explain. So once we get to the nitty-gritty, he can always say, actually, I forgot, or I was confusing it with a different case, right? He is fully able to do that. So what counsel should have done is say, did you testify? Yes. What I would imagine is that she lays out the facts as they were, the squad video, and compares it to what he actually said, right? That's how we do impeachment. There's typically no admission by the witness. I gave a press conference and I told everyone I lied. It's you ask them questions about the objective facts and then you ask them what they said about it, right? You impeach through inferences, typically. So then you argue to the jury, did you remember that testimony by Officer Vosacek? His squad video established X, Y, Z facts, but he testified in court as a sworn under oath witness to ABC facts. That matters. Are you to believe him in this trial when we know he lied under oath in a different hearing?
But in this case, and I know we're taking you out of time here.
Right ahead, Judge.
In this case, there wasn't really a dispute as to where this cooler was or what was in the cooler. It didn't seem to have the same set of circumstances where there were disputes about the evidence that I can tell from the record.
So first of all, Officer Vosacek did not take a single photograph of the vehicle, of the drugs where they were in the vehicle. We have no scene photographs. So it's actually incredibly problematic, and you may have noticed the record's a bit messy because we can't establish necessarily where everything was. So we needed that, right? Also, he gets to testify, and this is why it's related to issue four. Mr. Anderson lied, and oh, come on, he knew what was in there. So he's allowed to make that testimony without ever having his own credibility put into question. So I don't know that there were any factual disputes. Surely there were factual disputes about what Mr. Anderson knew and whether he knew the drugs were in that cooler.
Yeah, I could see that.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, it did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the state, please.
May it please the court. My name is Linda Fryer. I'm with the Office of the Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. Your Honor, I will begin with the last issue that was raised here, which was appellant's contention that the district court committed reversible error by admitting an objected to testimony by the officer regarding statements by appellant, that is, that he did not believe these statements. There was no objection here, but based on the record, that was clearly a tactical decision by defense counsel not to object here. Counsel's theory of the case was that appellant lied to him about the the passenger had lied about the drugs, and the defense counsel wanted to use the officer's testimony regarding the fact that he believed appellant had lied and the passenger had lied to then argue to the jury that, yes, this officer believed both of these people were lying, but he only focused his suspicion regarding the cooler on appellant, the driver of the car, and not on the passenger here. This was a rush to judgment that the police did not give the appellant a fair shake here, because they only focused on investigating him, not thoroughly investigating the passenger. And there is clear case law that when a defense counsel makes this kind of tactical decision based on the theory of the case, that the judge commits no error, no abuse of discretion by not interfering in that decision. Clearly, the defense counsel here knew that an objection could be made, because when a deputy began to give the same kind of testimony, that the statements by appellant that it was not his drugs were simply not credible. Defense counsel objected, and the court sustained that objection. But here, that an objection to testimony was not objected to because counsel decided that it would help her theory of the case, the defense theory of the case, to have statements by the officer that he did not believe either person in the car, but focused his suspicion solely on one person in the car. With respect to the court's decision not to allow the court order to be subject to examination at trial by defense counsel, the court said during the Rasmussen hearing, after first stating that she believed the order should not be considered at all at the Rasmussen hearing, that yes, she would accept the order into evidence at the Rasmussen hearing for purposes of appeal, that there was an issue here that could later be raised, and that order should be before the appellate court. But she made it at that time very clear at the Rasmussen hearing that in making her decision, she was not considering the substance of that order at the Rasmussen hearing, and she explicitly said that order would never go to the jury, that there could be no consideration of that order by the jury, that this was not the type of evidence that was contemplated by Rule of Evidence 608B. She clearly explained that having this order would be misleading and confusing to the jury, and that there would be a risk of relitigating the prior issue in the other case if this order were before the jury. She also clearly stated this was not proper impeachment evidence. It is not only, as the state explained in detail in its brief, highly prejudicial under the case law, but it would be a matter.
I'm inclined to agree with you on this issue, speaking for myself and not the panel. I guess I have a broader question on the, well, first of all, do you agree that the instruction relative to 15208 was error to give?
Yes. As the state pointed out in its brief, right, the Minnesota Supreme Court has consistently said that instruction should not be given. The state's position here is that given the evidence in this case and given the closing arguments of counsel, it was clearly harmless error here.
I guess the broader question I have is, I mean, this seems to keep happening, and I mean, and I understand it's harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt, and, you know, we've all talked about the evidence that would suggest that it's a harmless error, but, I mean, at some point it's necessary to say, well, stop doing this, and the only way we can prove it is to reverse it and give him a new trial, and perhaps this time this instruction won't be given. I mean, why shouldn't we do that?
The Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court have in the past said very clearly in cases, don't give this instruction. In some cases, they found it harmless error. In some cases, found it not to be harmless error. And in district court training, district courts are clearly instructive. Don't give these types of permissive inference instructions. We attempt in our office to give training to our attorneys saying, if judges want to give these, basically put up a big roadblock stop sign and say, don't do this. It's not clear why judges continue to do this, other than that the fact in some cases, such as this case, there is a statute. The judges are aware of that statute, and they believe they are following the law by following that statute. And quite frankly, the solution here would be for the state legislature to get rid of that specific statute and those types of statutes saying that a permissive inference can be drawn because those statutes are not in accordance with Minnesota Supreme Court law. And in these particular procedural areas, that's what the court should be looking at. But the problem is the district court judge's awareness of those statutes.
Ms. Fryer, I'm assuming, excuse me, but it's not in the jury instruction, it's not in the pattern jury instruction, so it still had to be
right,
affirmatively added, and apparently
the judge here did that. She was aware of the statute and thought that the statute was basically directing her to give that instruction. And she was clearly very aware of that statute, but not aware of appellate court cases in the state of Minnesota saying don't give this permissive inference instruction or these types of permissive inference instructions. But in many situations, the courts, the prosecutor's defense, run into that type of situation where the courts are aware of a statute. They research all the statutes related to the case. If there's a statute, they incorporate the statute into the instructions, believing that they're being directed by the state legislature to do that, and are not always aware or research the contrary law.
Is it your belief that but for his name on the lottery ticket in the cooler, that the Olson standard likely would be such we would have to reverse? Is that what the state would primarily hang its
I would not look solely at that piece of evidence. His name was on the lottery ticket, both the signature, the printed name, address, no, an address was on that lottery ticket in the cooler, but also he did make the admission in the phone, the jailhouse phone call, that it was the both of us. It's very difficult, if one looks at his entire paragraph statement, to draw any reasonable conclusion other than that he was admitting that the drugs in the car, in the cooler, were his, and that his passenger, VS, was going to basically take the fall for that. In addition, he had marijuana.
What was the cooler? He was the driver, right?
Right.
Was the cooler in the back, or was it?
It was in the front of. It was in the front of the car.
On the passenger side.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, you know, on the passenger side.
Down at her feet.
At her feet, yeah. But you know, obviously, his feet would be driving and using the gas pedal and the brake. So it would be far more difficult, given the size of the cooler, to have it there. So I don't think the reasonable inference can be drawn that it was her cooler, because it was a bit closer to her than it was to him. But he also admitted that the headphone in the case in the car was him, in that there was the same kind of THS marijuana wax container that was found in the cooler. He also admitted the marijuana in the head case was headphone case was his, and there was marijuana in the cooler. He also admitted to the use of meth and marijuana. So there are numerous pieces of evidence, basically, that unerringly point to him as the person who solely or jointly was possessing the drugs in that cooler. So it would simply be... the instruction is simply harmless error here. I would I believe I've covered most of the issues that were raised here this morning. The only thing I would simply say in response to the housekeeping matter that appellant's counsel raised was the state is not asserting that there was not an objection to the constructive possession objection. It's clear from the record there is. The state merely pointed out in footnote 2 of its brief that in its argument section, the appellants did not cite to the record. Appellant's citation was in the only with respect to the permissive inference instruction. The state only did this and has begun to do this in footnotes because increasingly counsel, and I'm not speaking of this particular counsel, but increasingly counsel, both in statements and facts and arguments and an appellant's brief, are simply not citing to the record. And at some points, the state has difficulty determining where, if at all, in the record, what they're actually referring to. And so the state has begun the practice of pointing that out so that the rules are very explicitly followed with citations to the record, so that there is simply no confusion between appellant and the state as to what the state is asserting. Here it's very clear in the record that there was an objection. The state's only quibble is that that was not cited in the argument section of the brief, pages 24 to 28. The state will then rest on its brief for the other issues, unless there are any questions from this court about those issues or the issues addressed today.
Thank you, Ms. Ferrer. Counsel for the appellant will have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to go back to the permissive inference instruction because I do think that's the most important issue in this case, and we all agree that it was error and objected to. This is not a harmless error, and that's what Olson says. Now, in the four cases that Minnesota Supreme Court has said, don't do this. Only one of them have they found harmless error. That was Labatt, which I think was first in time. The reason why is because the defendant in Labatt admitted knowledge of the drugs. That's the only case where the court has said, well, it probably wasn't that big of a deal to tell the jury they can infer knowledge because he admitted knowledge. Olson is, at a minimum, the kind of an equivalent level of facts to this case. Olson is a drugs-in-the-house case. There are no other people involved. There's no question about who the drugs were. The drugs are in Mr. Olson's house. They're kind of spread. They're in plain sight, put it that way. There's drugs in his house, and everybody can see them. And he admits that he saw them, which is pretty close to knowledge. This phone call is not as clear of an admission as that. And even if it is, Olson still says that's not enough. Olson still says...
Go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt.
The fact that he probably would have convicted anyways is not enough, is not beyond a reasonable doubt.
Would you agree that the approach we must take, though, is to look at the evidence and decide whether it's sufficient?
No. That's a sufficiency of the evidence analysis. The standard here is whether you can say beyond a reasonable doubt there was no significant impact on the verdict.
But don't you, in doing that assessment, have to look at the quantity of evidence?
I don't know that it's quantity, Your Honor. There's nothing that says we need five facts in our favor.
But just assess it in general. I mean, make a judgment as to what else the jury had before it.
Certainly. That is part of the analysis. Another part of the analysis is how did it affect the jury? That's the language, significant impact on the verdict. So imagine it this way. Imagine that the judge had also instructed the jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are allowed to infer, because the drugs were found at the passenger's feet, that she alone possessed them. If that sounds wrong, if that ruffles feathers, it's the same thing. It's just the instruction the judge actually gave is biased in favor of the state and not the defendant. That is what she did. She's not supposed to do it. It was her idea. She took this one factual inference. He's the driver, so he's guilty, and told the jury, you're allowed to do that. They're lay jurors. They follow instructions. We believe that. That's a black letter law tenet in the state of Minnesota. If they're told you're allowed to find him guilty because he's the driver and that's it, did they really assess the rest of the evidence? This is not a slam dunk case. I have cases all the time that are slam dunk cases in favor of the state, and this isn't one of them. There are lots of facts that these were her drugs and hers alone. Again, he's got no meth. He's got none on his person. He's got none in the stuff that he claims. And he's the one who's honest with the officers, right? He says, yep, there's a meth pipe, a marijuana pipe in my door. That headphone case is mine. He didn't have to be honest. And if he knew there were 55 grams of meth in that car, maybe he would have been less honest. But he was. She lies to the cop's face. She brings a baggie of meth into the jail in a coffee cup and tries to throw it away until they dump the liquid out and find it there. We know she lied. So there's a lot of facts that suggest they're only her drugs. Are there bad facts? Absolutely. There's no question. That's why this is a close case. But close case doesn't mean beyond a reasonable doubt there was no significant impact on this verdict. I didn't have time to address issue four, so just real briefly, this is about the officer's testimony. The one point I'd like to make is this. We did not raise ineffective assistance of counsel. Whether or not this was a tactical decision of counsel is irrelevant, and in fact somewhat offensive, that we would suggest that a public defender who did a great job in this case, her tactic was to allow the investigating officer to testify twice that her client lied, and twice, oh yeah, he totally knew those drugs were there. That is not a tactic. There is nothing in the record to suggest that was her tactic. She didn't do this first, right? This is not an opening the door situation. She responded to something that happened in a fast-moving trial and tried to ameliorate it after the fact. This was absolutely not a tactic, and that's irrelevant. We're in plain error. This court analyzes plain error evidentiary issues all the time. The reason we have plain error is because sometimes things happen and there was no objection. And if an error is serious enough to meet all the plain error tests, all the factors, all the hoops we have to jump through, that means it's a serious enough error that we remedy it. There's no exception for trial tactics. There's no authority cited by a respondent that says that's the case. What the state's asking you to do is just ignore the plain error test or adopt some sort of exception. I would ask you not to. In conclusion, there are lots of errors here. This is not a particularly fair trial. This is an officer who we know has had problems in the past. He's the only one there. He doesn't take pictures of anything. We're asked to trust him, and then he's also allowed to impugn my client several times, which is very clearly erroneous. Officers are not allowed to do that sort of testimony. Then the jury hears multiple erroneous instructions in a case that has close facts, not overwhelming facts. At a minimum, I would ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial based on the permissive inference instruction, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Yoke-Erickson. Thank you, Ms. Fryer. The matter is submitted.